The sun is setting on another day in Nagasaki. It's time to kick back with some matcha tea and wait. What is that thing? I think it's fish? Yikes. Anyway, I'm Sarah Rovang.
And I'm John Golden. And you're listening to Sundowners, conversations about architecture, place, and global travel. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, John. It's been nice waking up in the same place for six solid days, I have to say.
And in a Western-style bed, even. These little business hotels sure do get the job done. Super glad we're not staying in a hostel, particularly for this long. We're in a great location, too, right in downtown Nagasaki, a town we've both enjoyed quite a bit.
So, John, before we got here, what did you know about Nagasaki?
Probably the same thing that most of our U.S. listeners know, that this was one of the two cities where we dropped the bomb during World War II.
Yeah, I think that at least for Americans, Nagasaki is pretty much synonymous with the bombing that effectively ended World War II in the Pacific.
But that's not at all the Nagasaki that we experienced this week. Sure, there are frequent references on historic plaques and in museums about the bombing, but this is a city that has a lot more to distinguish itself.
The reason that we spent a week here is that Nagasaki could arguably be termed the birthplace of Western industrialization in Japan.
And the reason for Nagasaki's unique industrial history actually stretches back centuries to when it was the only port in all of Japan where foreign trade was allowed.
That history definitely shows in the architecture and the food here.
Compared to some of the cities we've visited so far, Nagasaki has felt a lot more cosmopolitan. We're staying near two areas that actually used to be artificial islands in the harbor, occupied for many decades by Chinese merchants and Dutch traders. Those islands eventually got subsumed into Nagasaki proper as they reclaimed more land from the harbor, and now are a small but lively Chinatown and an outdoor museum called the Jima we'll talk about later.
Seeing that part of Nagasaki's history helped us to kind of get a bigger picture view of Japan's industrial heritage. It's been a really productive week intellectually. I don't want to say that we are starting to quote-unquote understand Japan, but I think we're beginning to understand at least our reactions to Japan. What we think, how we feel, that kind of thing.
It's amazing how that happens when you just stop moving for a bit and have time to process and take things in. And along those lines, this week has also involved a growing recognition that we've definitely hit some kind of wall in terms of travel and, you know, just feeling exhausted after being on the road for so long.
Part of that is just timing. We've been traveling for 2.5 months now, and the travel adrenaline has kind of worn off by this point. Also, our travel in Japan has been at a much faster pace than South Africa. There is such an overwhelming density of sights to see and things to do. I've been pretty constantly going to sites or writing about sites or planning to get to the next sequence of sites.
And this week has been our first real chance to kind of catch our breaths and get a little distance on the experience so far, which has been nice and necessary.
And in that space, some more coherent thoughts about Japanese culture, architecture, and history making are starting to emerge.
It's definitely taking longer here than it did in South Africa to kind of locate the main narrative threads that we're following. Part of that has been the fast pace of travel, certainly, but I think it's also, you know, the language and cultural barrier. There's a lot more to parse here, and given the relative paucity of English signage in museums, we've kind of just had to pick up whatever breadcrumbs we can.
Part of it, I think, also just comes down to luck. We were talking last night about the importance of what I would call linchpin museums in a public history landscape. Those institutions that kind of help you put together the story from a bunch of other sites. We really lucked out in South Africa because we had that experience on our third full day in Johannesburg at the Workers Museum.
We've talked about this museum before, and it comes up in both of your first two SAH blog posts, Sarah. And for good reason. It was really the public history experience that helped us find a concrete, a graspable window into apartheid, and really helped link things with industrialization, too.
And we kind of kept coming back to that Workers' Museum knowledge as a reference for the rest of our time in South Africa. The interesting thing is that which sites work as linchpin experiences is pretty subjective, and not necessarily even a museum that's trying to be comprehensive or create some big master narratives about a place or culture.
Yeah, it's about finding that entry point, you know, that story that helps you bridge the gap and connect other stories to one another. You know, so you might have thought that the apartheid museum in Johannesburg would be that linchpin, but we both found it too big, too overwhelming to serve that role.
This week, we finally had that experience at Dejima, which is an open-air museum / archaeological project / multimedia interpretive experience. I'm not exactly sure how to describe it, actually.
Well, originally Dejima was the artificial island where first the Portuguese traders lived and then the Dutch. Japan didn't want Christianity spreading when the Portuguese showed up, so they sequestered them on this island. And later when the Dutch East India Company arrived, they also lived on the island.
Can't avoid the Dutch East India Company. I thought we'd get a break from the Dutch after South Africa.
Nope. The Dutch played an outsized role in bringing European materials, technology, and ideas to Japan.
So this tiny little fan-shaped island for a long time was Japan's single point of contact with the European community during its centuries of self-imposed isolation. And now, the community of Nagasaki has a long-term plan to restore the whole island.
Which was burned in a series of fires over the years.
Back to the way that it would have been in the early 1800s. Today, they have completed many of the restorations, and it really gives a vivid sense of what it must have felt like to be a trader living on this island.
As a public history experience, it was super compelling and engaging as well. Basically, the visitor gets to choose their own route through the island and explore almost 20 different buildings, all of which have information about their original usage, alongside interesting displays and interactives.
It was a really nice blend of analog and digital, too. There were a couple of well-done projections and digital animations, but these were interspersed with a lot of original artifacts and helpful signage. And there were plenty of tactile non-digital things to do, too, like operating a static electricity machine based on Western models, or playing the Dutch game of billiards.
But I think even more critically, these various storytelling methods really made the historical context a lot more accessible. And it was super helpful historical content, too, in terms of understanding how Japan has related to the rest of the world, from the 1500s up until the period of industrialization in the 1800s.
Really helpful background for all of the late 19th and early 20th century sites that we've been seeing.
And I guess the other factor was that Dejima felt the most familiar of all the industry-related sites that we've seen. It had the kind of narratives and approaches to storytelling that one would expect to see in a modern Western museum.
So we took that experience and considered it alongside all of the other museum experiences we've had so far here on Industrial Kyushu, which, again, is something that we've finally had the time to do this week. We had a great chat, for instance, last night over pizza and wine on the Nagasaki waterfront.
And now it feels like there are a couple big takeaways or ideas starting to emerge from our time here. And as a big disclaimer to all of this, these are not particularly original realizations, and they aren't very nuanced or necessarily even correct. And we know that there's a lot more to the story than we've picked up so far.
These are merely the prosaic opinions of two gaijin who don't speak Japanese and have just been to a lot of museums in the past 3 weeks. And as our listeners in the museum business know well, there's a lot of inertia in museums, and it can take a while for museum storytelling to catch up with the methods and perspectives of academic history writing. Just because a bunch of history professors are doing cutting-edge labor history, for instance, doesn't mean that museums are suddenly going to redo their exhibits along those lines.
Okay, so disclaimer over.
So, the main relationship that occupied us in South Africa was that between industrialization and apartheid. Here in Japan, we're coming to understand that the big back and forth, it has to do with the relationship between industrialization and nationalism.
Yeah, the sense of Japanese national identity seems indelibly tied together with industrialization, in a way that is honestly quite unique in the world. So, studying the legacy of industrialization gives a really powerful lens into understanding modern Japan.
I think there are two things that have really stood out to both of us at many of the sites that we've visited. The first is how incontrovertibly positive all of the interpretations of industrialization have been. There was this really strong narrative in place that industrialization helped Japan become the rich and powerful nation that it is today. But there's no real examination of environmental impacts, or the exploitation of labor, or even acknowledgement of the societal turmoil resulting from all of the rapid changes Japan went through during the period of opening to the West and industrializing. Going by the representations in the museums we've seen, You'd have to think that Japan went from being an entirely closed-off, pre-industrial nation to a global manufacturing powerhouse in 50 years without any negative consequences or difficulties.
And the second point is that there's this weird tension or kind of double consciousness that a lot of Japan's industrialization came through the adoption of Western technology, but also there's this desire to cast Japan's industrialization as uniquely Japanese. Basically, all the sites we've been to have really emphasized that Japan is the only non-Western country to industrialize, quote, on their own terms. There's been incredibly little discussion of the cultural content of that technology and its transfer, or you know, what does it even mean for something to be the first Japanese-designed engine?
I think double consciousness is a great term for it, and connects back with what I was saying about the surprising lack of nostalgia for a pre-industrial era here. There doesn't seem to be as much nostalgia because in many ways people appear to act as if the past, the ways of the past, are still, in essence, fully alive. And yet there's also this dual attachment to the Japan of the future, of technology and industry.
Yeah, one does often get the sense here of trying to have your cake and eat it too. Side note, that's actually a very funny joke, because Nagasaki is famous for this type of cake called castellaneta, which is originally from the Portuguese, but has been appropriated by Nagasaki, and now they sell it everywhere in these shops, which look like, I swear, luxury watch stores, but for cake, and a slice of cake is like $20. It's almost like the cake is a metaphor.
You know it's a funny joke when you have to explain it.
Hey, you have to admit, it works pretty well.
No, you're right. It's good. Anyway, so there are these two critical relationships that we've identified. First is that between modern Japan and its pre-industrial past, and the second is between Japan and the West. In both cases, we've picked up a sense of an almost queasy superposition, this double consciousness, having your cake and eating it too. Japan is both futuristic and anchored in the past, both stridently unique and connected to Western industrialism. I'm excited to continue thinking about these ideas. I'm sure we'll continue talking about them as well here and on our blog posts.
Yeah, it's good stuff. Really too much to get into during one podcast. But these are clearly some powerful themes that we'll revisit during the rest of our 5 weeks in Japan. But I think before we get too much more into those ideas, we could talk more about some of the specific sites we visited over the last week, and also some takeaways from this period of the Brooks travel in southern Japan.
So as our regular listeners may recall from last week, we're on the island of Kyushu, largely to explore the series of UNESCO sites that were designated in 2015, collectively titled Sites of Japan's Meiji Industrial Revolution. That's kind of a mouthful, so we'll call it JMIR for short. These are about two dozen different sites that are mostly on Kyushu and the southern part of Honshu, where we're headed the week after next.
And those sites have been grouped into three chronological time periods to help visitors understand where they each fit in with the larger story of Japan's industrialization. The first is trial and error experimentation, then it's direct importation of Western technology, and finally, full-blown industrialization.
The site that we talked about in our podcast last week, Shuisaiken, was part of the trial and error period, where the Japanese were using whatever technology and craft they already had and trying to figure out how to reverse engineer Western things like ironclad warships. And that really didn't go so great a lot of the time.
But then, once the Meiji era started and Japan opened its doors, Westerners started showing up and helping the Japanese build factories and adapt existing management techniques.
We saw some sites that were pretty critical in this part of the story in Nagasaki, for instance, the Glover Garden. Thomas Glover was a Scotsman who was instrumental in kickstarting a lot of industry in and around Nagasaki. He brought over some of his friends in other industries as well, and they also did very well for themselves. Glover even married a Japanese woman, and their son became another important industrialist in Japan.
Yeah, so it was interesting at sites like the Glover Garden to see how much that Western heritage has kind of been embraced. The site consists of Glover's former house and gardens, and then several other Western houses that have been moved here as well. The whole thing felt, you know, celebratory. Glover is portrayed very favorably, as are all of his family and friends.
Architecturally, it's been interesting to see how historic Western architecture has quite romantic connotations here. I guess it's not that different from Westerners, like me, I must admit, who find Japanese gardens, for instance, kind of exotic and picturesque. But it's been kind of a theme of our trip so far. There was this historic Western district in Hakodate, and then the European parts of Nagasaki, like the Glover Garden. And now we're headed up to a town called Mochiko, which is full of Western Meiji buildings, and is widely regarded as a romantic place to take a date.
And this all kind of goes back to what we were talking about before, the double consciousness around the West as a useful point for extracting technology, but also definitely an exotic other.
As a Western scholar, I'm most used to reading about how other Westerners exoticized Japan, but it's been interesting to observe the extent to which that othering gaze between Japan and the West really did go both ways.
So while Shuisaikan and the Glover Garden were clearly big tourist attractions even before the UNESCO inscription, this really has not been typical of our experiences of the other sites on the J-MIR list.
Not at all. It has been really challenging to get to some of these sites, particularly on public transportation. We ran into that challenge in Omura, which is a city about halfway between Kagoshima and Nagasaki, where we stopped on our way north last week.
Omura is clearly super proud and excited of its J-MIR sites. There were big signs about it as soon as we got off the train.
Unlike Nagasaki and Kagoshima, which are big, bustling cities that have diverse economies, Omura felt like a deindustrializing town where a new income source has not arisen to replace coal mining. So they really seem to have embraced the idea of industrial tourism.
At least that was the initial impression. And there was a nice map at the visitor center telling you how to see all the sites on the Coal Heritage Trail. And there were lots of coal mining related souvenirs you could buy.
But then in practice, getting out to the sites was kind of challenging. The buses were infrequent and it was a long hike between the sites.
If only certain Brooks fellows knew how to ride a bike.
Yes, well, that still wouldn't have changed the fact that once we actually got out to some of these coal pits, they were pretty much closed up, and the online interpretive features didn't appear to be working. The website said that they would be all open that day, but that's certainly not what we found when we showed up.
But, you know, it was still definitely an informative and interesting experience. It's always an adventure. One of the nice things about Japan is that it has felt safe, regardless if we're in downtown Tokyo or walking down the street in a former coal mining town in rural Kyushu.
The other issue we've encountered regarding accessing the J-MIR sites is that some are connected to corporations. Mitsubishi in Nagasaki, for instance, that were and still are successful businesses. And those historic sites are actually on company land.
We had to have our very kind and patient hotel concierge call Mitsubishi to get us in to see the former pattern factory, for instance.
Which was, again, definitely worthwhile, but further highlighted the relative inaccessibility of many of these sites. On paper, all of the J-MIR sites are presented as equals, but in practice, there are certain sites that are easier to get to, have more and better interpretation on site, and are also more accessible to non-Japanese speakers. But it's hard to identify which those sites are going to be, though, even with in-depth internet research beforehand. You really just have to show up and find out. We've definitely encountered the limits of internet research in other ways recently as well, particularly when it came to dining in Nagasaki.
Well, before we get to that, I should say that, as we mentioned in the beginning, we've really enjoyed Nagasaki quite a bit. There are a surprising amount of fun old neighborhoods right here in the downtown, and they escaped too much damage during World War II since they were separated from the drop site by a bunch of hills.
On a couple of occasions, we went wandering up in those hills, and it was really pretty. There are all of these tiny paths meandering between houses and shrines, and there was this huge cemetery up on the side of this big steep hill.
We ended up climbing up the top of one of those hills after dinner one night, kind of by accident, and the view was amazing. We were the only people around, and it was just so cool to see how the city winds and wends its way around the bay and up into the hills, and it's a really gorgeous area.
We've also eaten really well here, for the most part. The downtown area that we're in has a lot of great small restaurants. You can read more about that on John's Foodways blog, but yeah, the ramen and dumplings and curries around here have all been delicious.
Though, as you alluded to, we did have a couple of, shall we say, difficult meals. I think these meals are actually good examples of both the difficulty of traveling in Japan and some of this cultural dissonance and double consciousness that we talked about earlier.
The two meals we are referring to actually happened basically back to back. Dinner one night and then lunch the next day. And both were in a highly traditional Nagasaki style called Shippoku Ryori.
Yeah, the first dinner we did on the recommendation of Lonely Planet, and then earlier in the week we had made reservations for a fancy lunch the following day to celebrate Sarah's birthday. So it was kind of by accident that we had two of these very traditional meals right in a row.
But I think that based on all of the available information, it seemed like a fine idea. Both places got great reviews online, and it seemed like they would have a nice historical element too, which was a draw as well. The place we went to on my birthday purportedly has the oldest Western-style room in Japan.
But maybe we should have noticed that only three or four of the reviews were by non-Asian people, and this is out of like hundreds of reviews online. So we went in totally unprepared for how difficult these meals would be for our Western palates.
The Shippoku Ryori style, like many in Japan, features a ton of different dishes, with various cooked and raw fishes, meats, and vegetables. And there are definitely no English translations to help you figure out what you're eating.
Which I'm usually fine with. But in this case, once I realized that this egg custard sitting on top of a seafood soup actually was an egg custard sitting on top of whale soup, I started feeling a bit queasy. I mean, look, I appreciate all the cultural relativism arguments, but I am increasingly discovering on this trip just how tenuous my moral grip is on eating meat in general, and in particular eating the meat of one of the most sentient, intelligent, and endangered creatures on the planet is just not something I'm down with. Plus, it doesn't taste very good.
The rest of the meal didn't do much to help put us at ease either. Lots of very funky fish flavors, huge shells filled with rubbery sea whelks, and then plenty of things of totally unknown origin or creature type.
Even the simple things, or things that in other meals would have tasted good, became challenging in this context. For example, there was this little plate at the end of one of our meals that contained what I thought to be some green grapes, a little sesame cookie, and a white cube of some kind of jello-like thing. You know, a little dessert plate. In practice, it turned out to contain some very large individual green beans, the likes of which I'd never seen before, a thin slice of fish encrusted in sesame seeds, and a jello thing that was fish flavored. They all tasted fine, the beans were actually kind of cool, but geez, you just could not catch a break during these meals.
It was really surprising to us that there weren't more warning signs online that this cuisine was so challenging.
And I was totally unprepared for the whale thing. We didn't see it at all up in Hokkaido, so I don't know if this is a regional specialty or what. But I do know, and have recently read up a bit more about, Japan's strong attraction to whaling. This has been a pain point between Japan and other countries around the world. And the Japanese view on these things does seem to be, again, a sort of have your whale and eat it too.
By coincidence, this last week, John's mom sent us a National Geographic article about the ivory trade in Japan, which is now the largest country in the world where ivory is still legal. Apparently, it's quite popular here, usually carved into small figurines which are given as gifts for special occasions.
Yeah, and after China made it illegal a couple years ago, the pressure has really been put on Japan, and they've not reacted well. It was a frustrating article to read, but again, it picked up on a lot of these themes of Japan being really tied to something in its past and bristling at any kind of censure from other countries. And the ivory thing is particularly frustrating because they have shown very little contrition on the topic. Their defense is basically along the lines of, we do not condone poaching, we are trading only in existing ivory, which is an important cultural and historical tradition in Japan. And basically all of those statements are false. You know, obviously any market for ivory will effectively promote poaching. And as far as a historical tradition, Japanese carving of ivory only really began in the 1800s, and was in large part spurred on by Western interest in the carved figurines. Their prominence in inter-Japanese cultural exchanges is actually quite recent. Anyway, sorry for the rant.
I think at the end of the day, every culture, every country has its problems and inconsistencies and double consciousnesses. But I think it's fair to say that more is done here to suppress these issues than we're used to, and so they can really sneak up on you. This week, they kind of hit us all at once.
Again, as opposed to South Africa, where they hit you the second you walk off the plane.
Right. But fortunately, in the face of that, I think we're both getting better at recognizing and confronting the emotional toll that it can take to process all of this overwhelming sensory and intellectual input.
Yeah, this week we tried hard to identify and pursue things that just made us feel more at home, whether that means watching a movie in our hotel room or being okay with going to the same restaurant multiple times.
The ramen place across the street made the most amazing vegetarian tomato and eggplant ramen, and the Beatles were on the stereo every time we went there.
We're trying to take better care of ourselves and own up to how hard travel can be.
And we'll leave it there for this week. As always, our theme music is by Mark Barrett.
Join us next week where we'll be back on the main island of Honshu as we slowly work our way back up to Tokyo.
Happy trails, listeners!